Yes, I think so. I've had major concerns around the New Zealand Environmental Protection Authority and our Ministry for Primary Industries, MAF before that, for their lack of vision and their lack of standing up against industry to actually do the right thing. We have conflicts of interest. I've exposed some in the past. In the Environmental Protection Authority, the people that are actually making those decisions around what is safe and what the safety levels should be, whether genetically engineered material should be released or whatever. And in my view, there needs to be changes at the very highest point of staffing of the Environmental Protection Authority. And there'll be some excellent people in there, but there are some people there that I believe shouldn't be there because of things that they've said in the past in the way of promoting genetic engineering, promoting chemicals, and saying that our legislation needs to change to make these things, particularly the GE, more easily to be released. And to have someone that said that to be the chief executive of the EPA is a very, very poor thing.
Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Green Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Green Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth. At present, New Zealand has a government comprised of three political parties, with Labour, New Zealand First and the Green Party, which is an interesting balance as it has social elements, conservative business awareness, as well as ecological elements, which, if dynamically balanced, may be able to serve the interest of a very divergent and holistic New Zealand community. That also nestled in the largest party, Labour, are Māori, who have a very intimate connection to the land and the living earth. With a young mother and her newly born, we have Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, who in many ways added to the vocabulary in the election, speaking up generational change, which, to ramp it up, could also mean heralding a new paradigm of thinking and innovation. As New Zealand was the last country to be colonialised from the European theatre, it has in many ways been an incubator country where women claimed the right to vote in 1893, and being one of the first to have an 8-hour working day, many welfare state benefits, and the second country on earth to abolish the death penalty days after Sweden, and being the first major nuclear-free country and getting close to becoming a legal GE-free country, plus having a happiness indicator, are all part of our country's makeup. So, what of tomorrow? Can we be a world leader with a new empowering vision of connection and aroha? If there was a chance to make this possible, it is today. In the studio this morning, I have Stephen Browning, who spent 6 years in the New Zealand Parliament as an MP for the Green Party, and he is now outside the political realm, but still very busy endeavouring to bring about positive change, especially in environmental and ecological considerations. So, kia ora, Stephen.
Kia ora, Tim.
Stephen, I think, was just so synchronistic. I didn't have anybody to interview today, and you rang me yesterday afternoon, and I thought, wow, this is fantastic. You were in Auckland. So I'm so pleased that you're here.
Thanks, Tim.
Yeah, because we need to be able to cover the future of New Zealand. I'm totally dedicated to the fact that we have to make sure that our children of today and tomorrow have a future and a biosphere that will sustain us for the next billion years.
Yep.
And we have to get serious at the moment as well.
Things are rather desperate in lots of ways. There are some good news stories, but the monster seems to be carrying on degrading our environment.
Very much so. So can I cover a few things? And can you mention quickly the portfolios that you held within the Green Political Party whilst you were in Parliament?
Primary production, that of course included agriculture, horticulture, forestry, and I had fisheries for a good part of my time there, not all of it. We had safe food for a small period. There's some politics around that, so we didn't hold on to that. I had security and intelligence for a period as well. And biosecurity, you could say that's part of the primary production area. Food safety all the way through.
Well, it's imperative that we make sure that we're putting the right food into our body. And I've heard for many years now that the organic sector has, in many ways, been supported by the rich mums over New Zealand who can afford to pay top dollar to make sure that their babies and their children get the highest quality food.
Yes, and in terms of the portfolios, of course, organics had a separate portfolio there that I had all the way through, and genetic engineering as well. So, yes, sure, here that organic food is seen as unaffordable or too expensive is more the point. I would say there's a difficulty of being able to afford it by a number of people. We have to consider the true cost of production of food. We have to ensure that our producers, and particularly our small growers, of the finest quality, healthiest, highest nutrition food, they in fact can survive economically. And so it's about the true cost of production. If they cannot get to be able to feed their children and put a roof over their heads, there is something wrong. The issue is we are comparing organic food with what we call conventional food that is produced cheaply with the use of some very ugly chemicals and some very ugly fertilizers, for that matter, that degrade our rivers, but the chemicals acting on our health. And there are a considerable amount of chemicals in conventional food. Now, how do you compare that price? That's cheap food, made cheap because the cost of the externalities, the cost of those chemicals onto our health system and into our environment is not considered in that retail price. The organic food, the full cost is carried by the producer and they must get a reasonable return. It can be cheaper, but it can't be a lot cheaper. Sometimes in peak season, and when I was a producer for 17 years, my product was no more expensive. I had high volume, but it was no more expensive than the conventional in the peak season. But overall, yes, it has to be a little bit more expensive because the rest is subsidised by the cheap chemicals.
Yes, now this subsidisation of cheap chemicals, how does this come into being quickly?
Yeah, it makes it easy for a producer to deal with pests. Go blitz it with some heavy chemical.
Blanket. Yeah.
And even when they do integrated pest management and they use it occasionally, it is still a very easy fix. And that, even if it's an expensive chemical, the amount that is used and spread out, that is very dangerous for the people and in the food and for children. That is still a cheap option for dealing with that crop and ensuring that crop comes through to harvest. For the organic producer, we've got far less of those sort of tools to be able to use.
Very good. Just quickly, what food item did you produce?
I was growing capsicum, aubergine, beans, cucumber, chilies, tomatoes, basil were my primary ones.
Yeah. Gosh, yeah, a good spectrum. Now, this just came into my mind. Insects. We are losing our insects. I know that 20 years ago in summer, I could drive 50 kilometres across a rural sector and have to clear my windscreen and a service station of all these squashed insects and bugs. Yes. Today, that's not the case at all. What do you think is the reason for this,
yes,
Stefan?
That significant reduction will be coming through two parts. One is the habitat for those insects is gone because we're bare-earthing things. We're taking a lot of trees and shrubs and diversity out of the environment. But really, then we have those chemicals, the neonicotinoids, the neonics we call them for short. We know kill the bees and damage the bees. They kill and damage a wide spectrum of other insects as well. And so do a number of other insects and fungicides for that matter and a few other sides, herbicides as well, all have their effect on our insect life. And it's imperative that that's reversed. And it's great to see that in Europe, France is a great example, actually, of the pushback against these sorts of chemicals so that they can try and restore the ecological balance in their environments.
Thank you. I was just with a person in Germany last week, and she said there are so many organic stores right across France, and France are actually doing some pretty potent things around stopping planned obsolescence and small, what you call, consumer items, but I don't want to go there. So, but the French also making sure that food that's in a supermarket can, once it gets close to its use-by date, it's actually then used for other purposes, like goes into prisons or hospices or whatever, and it's still got quality. So the French are out there in certain areas where they have what you call a social conscience in many ways.
Yeah, and some of the big businesses over there, the major supermarket chains as well, are saying, yeah, we want to sell this produce, but they're telling the growers of those produce, we're not going to accept it if you've used neonicotinoids in the production. Now, that's coming through from, obviously, the people, but there's the commercial outlets that recognise the wave of consumer interest in that. What we actually do need is our regulators, our EPAs, Environmental Protection Authorities, and the likes of governments to be saying, we're going to do the right thing and we're going to stop it, rather than wait until things have absolutely collapsed, it seems, before they actually change. So we need to keep the pressure on in New Zealand here, on my colleagues in Parliament and the regulators. We need some major changes in there.
When you say major changes, this is serious if it's major?
Yes, I think so. I've had major concerns around the New Zealand Environmental Protection Authority and our Ministry for Primary Industries, MAF before that, for their lack of vision and their lack of standing up against industry to actually do the right thing. We have conflicts of interest. I've exposed some in the past. In the Environmental Protection Authority, the people that are actually making those decisions around what is safe and what the safety levels should be, whether genetically engineered material should be released or whatever. And in my view, there needs to be changes at the very highest point of staffing of the Environmental Protection Authority. And there'll be some excellent people in there, but there are some people there that I believe shouldn't be there because of their things that they've said in the past in the way of promoting genetic engineering, promoting chemicals, and saying that our legislation needs to change to make these things, particularly the GE, more easily to be released. And to have someone that said that to be the chief executive of the EPA is a very, very poor thing. So we'll see what changes come along the way in time on that, but we need to have a different vision, a different level of precaution, and the community and the environment has to be at the forefront before the economy.
Thank you, yes. I mean, the whole GE thing, just recently we've had Napier, and I'd like you to quickly give a one-minute story about what's happening in the Hastings area and also up North Auckland, because essentially we have got two major GE-free areas, and this may finally get the government or have the government have the mandate when more areas in New Zealand go GE-free to actually lock that down in legislation so that we can say nuclear-free New Zealand and GE-free New Zealand.
Yes, so in New Zealand there's been some fantastic work done in the regions from GE-free Northland and Soil and Health Association that I've just got back onto the National Council of, GE-free New Zealand as well. They've ended up right up into the High Court to ensure that the councils in those areas and in the Hawke's Bay and Bay of Plenty to some degree too, I was involved with that one, get precaution and rules set so that those councils can make decisions around not having genetic engineering released into their environments. And that includes those new forms of GE like gene editing, CRISPR and all that. There's been so much PR to be pushing them as safe and all of that. And the science is showing that actually they have their unexpected outcomes too. And it's so good to see that the European Union has just come out and said, no, they have to be treated just like any genetic engineering. So we've got vested interest in scientists that have maybe got the blinkers on in New Zealand, concerned it will stall innovation in New Zealand. It will not. They can still use those tools in the laboratories to discover new aspects of plants and animals, for that matter, that can be used in a non-GE setting and use that knowledge that they might gain. But to actually put that in to a product or plant or animal into the environment, it would be totally reckless. And there's other improvements in the plant production that can be made, but we do not need to use to release those products into our environment.
The precautionary principle has to be adhered to.
Yes, it does. And in New Zealand, we seem to be very slow around that. We're very interested in uptakers of new technology. It's a bit like the short man syndrome or something. We have to reach out for these big so-called advances. We're scared we're going to be left behind. New Zealand has an opportunity of doing what people really think New Zealand is. It's the clean, green, 100% pure direction. Our consumers overseas, and we're an exporting country, they expect that of us. They expect it pure as possible country. There's nothing to stop us still going for that. The use of these technologies, fine in understanding something, but our consumers expect pesticide-free, GE-free production and leaving our rivers in a pristine state. We can do that, and it's so good to see the growth in organics and the Vigeta government's behind organics and call regenerative agriculture systems, those sort of things. We will go a long way towards getting best value for our products from New Zealand at the same time as having a clean, safe environment.
I still see New Zealand as being an arc of organic and, as you say, clean potential, a country so that we can feed the world. And as I've found out, when I go overseas and meet overseas people, they see New Zealand as the ordinary New Zealand is a very good, warm, honest person. So how is it that just a few people at the top of the pyramid can actually, shall we say, manipulate the DNA for personal gain? And so I'm looking forward to this change happening, and I've come across so many young kids or young people from 16, 17, 20 who have even gone now vegan as part of another shift that's coming in, that they really only want to have more plant material growing. I mean, the hemp is a possibility in New Zealand, particularly when it comes to pulling down CO2 out of the atmosphere and making sure that the soil remains on the land and not run off under the sea or the drains and creeks, etc. So there is a shift going on with biological and regenerative agriculture, isn't there?
Yes, there is. There's certainly quite a movement with, as you say, young people, but through to older people. I recently turned 64 and I'm effectively dairy-free in my diet at this point, which is not that I'm opposed to the dairy industry in total, but I'm doing for a range of reasons, both health, which I'm seeing benefit of, and also not being part of that intensive dairy production. Lots of young people seem to be doing that, and I'm very, very pleased to see Bailey Perryman and Penelope Bundy just been voted on to the Soil and Health National Council. So along with myself and Marion Wood from Common Sense Organics in Wellington, we are new national councillors, but we've got that youth
vitality
and connection. I've got plenty of vitality, but they've got more.
Yeah.
And it's going to be really exciting with that organisation, which will do a major thing about growing its membership and reaching out to those young people to get that connection with those that are very concerned, say, about climate change, and through to those that are looking at the diet. Sometimes some of those same people reaching out for that aren't actually even understanding the connections right back to what's happening in the deep ecological systems in agriculture.
Yes.
And just to get everyone to join the dots and to see what we can actually achieve in this country, it should be fun.
I agree, because I see things from a standpoint of the biosphere. I mean, everything's interconnected, and I just love deep ecology. And when we get to find out there that it's the bacteria and the microorganisms, the fungi in the soil, that really is the driver of all the growth, particularly how plants feed and the root connections, etc., it's magical there.
It is, and yet successive governments have sucked out this, taken, dropped the positions of soil scientists at major universities at the same time as effectively doing hydroponic farming with urea and whatever, and most visible, but not only in the intensive dairy industry, but to be losing soil scientists where that is the core of our agriculture and better understanding. So a rebuild in that area will be very, very important.
Fantastic. What I want to do is quickly just cover a whole number of things. Air. The air in New Zealand, pretty good, sort of?
It depends where you are.
Okay,
I'm in Marlborough. We've got massive amount of viticulture. I don't actually like that I'm living in Blenheim sometimes because I know there will be a major amount of chemical drift, and we have far too many people with cancers and different degenerative diseases.
Thank you. Yes. I was up at Matakana a couple of days ago, and there was a woman selling olive oil. And I said, have you got organic olive oil? She said, look, it's too awkward for us to be able to get, what's the word?
Certification.
She said, we've got all these vineyards around, and the drift from all the sprays makes it so awkward for us. And so she said, look, we can't actually say that. And so this is a big problem.
It is a big problem, but one thing I can say is that in Marlborough we have a significant growth in organic viticulture too, but fortunately the growth in conventional is outstripping it. But there's no need to buy non-organic wine anymore. So that's a good way that consumers can work on, is buy organic products to support that demand.
Very good. And the particulates coming out of exhaust, I mean, Japanese have done quite well in making sure that there's catalytic converters and et cetera on vehicles. The electric car is going to make a little difference, I presume, too. So you feel that in general, but we also have respiratory problems, don't we?
There are respiratory problems, and some of that we see from, we put into the issues around housing, but some of that will be through the chemicals in food as well.
Yes.
There'll be a range of reasons for respiratory problems, and it's not the area that I'm so familiar with.
Very good. Now we'll quickly go on to water, because the Greens actually did a good program about, I don't know, 6 or 7, 8 years ago, where they picked out all the rivers, and I actually put my own little stream that went through our place, Rapu Rapu, at Te Poi and Maramara under the Kaimai Ranges. And whereas a kid, I used to swim and drink at the same time. It was the most lovely feeling, and I could look down and I'd put a mask on and I could see trout, and the stones were yellow, brown and white and beautiful. Now, if I go down there now, I won't put my head under the water because of the fact that intensive desertification and a lot of fertilisers runoff off the land. So our water.
Yeah, our water's been well exposed as being as filthy as it is. Another thing, I mean, that's the both microbials with the E. coli's and the likes, the nitrogens and that affect the ecology. And we also have the third world forestry practices that are bringing loads of sediments down into our rivers and into our estuaries and, you know, affecting our fisheries as well. So we've got major problems with water. It's so fantastic that it's been politicised, publicised.
Yes.
And I'm very, very proud of the Green Party for being a big part of that. But it's not only, it's plenty of NGOs as well. And so that there is that increased pressure to clean up and tidy up our rivers. And there's so many good examples of people. Raglan was a great story.
Yes.
But other areas increasingly where the community is just not accepting it and or getting involved in restoration. I think the farming community that has been the drainers and the major part of polluters, they need better education on how they may restore it, but they have to take a strong responsibility themselves in restoring it too, rather than putting the hand out that they so often will criticise others for. And now they're reaching out and thinking that they should be supported fully to clean up their act. Well, I think there's a high level should be expected of those, the perpetrators themselves, to do the cleanup.
Yeah, very good. Greg Hart, are you familiar with Greg?
Yes.
He's doing some wonderful work in restoring all the around his lake, etc. And so there are people out there which are, it's so good to see living examples, because his farm is basically an organic farm, yeah, pretty close to that, working towards that. And so, yes, our lakes and the nitrates and that sort of thing, gosh, what a...
I mean, it's a joy to be on some of those properties.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yeah, well, I mean, he wakes up in the morning and he knows that what he's doing is good for the world, because he's not going out with, some people have to go and spray everything, and every farmer who wakes up in the morning think, God, I'm producing food and I'm spraying it with poisons and God knows what else. They've lost their spark. It's a soulless industry for them. Whereas the people there who are wanting to restore and regenerate the land and have all these different animals like Greg does, it makes a whole difference. He gets up with joy.
That's right. And as much as I'm tough on on farmers, and hey, I was a glasshouse vegetable producer, so I understand the pressure they're under in terms of making ends meet and getting there. But there is responsibility there to clean up, but there also needs to be strong educational tools. There need to be people there available to
pass on the knowledge.
Yeah, to help them transition back. And I say back because it wasn't always like this, back into more sustainable systems. And the government's got a major role in that, and they should be having organic advisory and generative agriculture type systems in place. So there needs to be changes in MPI so that there's people that are actually not set
conscious
in the old system.
People.
Yes, conscious people that actually know what's needed and actually can help make it happen from a policy direction onwards.
Very good. Well, when it comes to water, the Whanganui River, when the government about 2 years ago passed legislation so that the Whanganui River was classified as an entity, it thrilled me. It totally filled me up, realising that the catchment area is over 7,000 square kilometres. That's a huge area, and Māori were just overjoyed because it was a New Zealand first. It was nearly pushing the world first too, because science is leading us, Steph, into the fact that our planet is essentially a superorganism. And when James Lovelock brought out the Gaia theory or Gaia hypothesis, all of a sudden, most of the people who were really interested in it were the ones who had a spiritual understanding of connection of nature and all of life, and all the indigenous peoples globally lit up to the degree they said, hey, white man, guess what we've been trying to tell you for the last 300 years? And so, again, there's a new consciousness to the fact that our planet lends us a body and it lends us free air, free rainwater, and until recently a free food chain. So there is again a greater consciousness coming, and we're seeing things in whole systems, and that the whole biosphere is one living mass of profound life.
That's right. And systems as
systems,
acknowledging genuine ecological systems is important. I've spoken with Crown Research Institute scientists, and I talk about systems to them, and they'll say, yeah, we've got systems, but their understanding of systems is very shallow.
Yes.
And I don't know if I was told you before, Tim, I remember being at one of our Crown Research Institute stands at the National Field Days at out near Hamilton there.
Yes. Mystery Creek.
Mystery Creek. And here was a video running of plantain, a very useful part of a mixed sward for stock. It helps make a very healthy diet if it's one of the many plants in their diet in a mixture. But of course, now that they've woken up to that, they do a paddock of
plantain.
And next door might
monoculture.
Be monoculture.
Oh,
and next door there'll be one of chicory.
Yeah.
And then there'll be the ryegrass and clover or whatever. And they'll say this is a systems, but it is still not a mixed diet on the day for it. And then they were having pest problems because they had all these moths and caterpillars eating the plantain. I said, what's that? And they said, oh, plantain moth. Now, I've never heard of plantain
moth.
Me
neither.
But it would have been around forever and a day.
Yes.
It's only a problem when they treat it in a monoculture. So their understanding of systems is quite shallow, it seems.
Separation.
Yes. It's
separation.
It's
not
great.
Integration.
That's right. And so, the farmers can put on quality into the stock, maybe, but they would much, much better if they could actually integrate those crops altogether. Yeah. But that's how it used to be. And we'll get some
there.
Of it back, and we'll have improvements in it as well when we get there.
Because we have real healthy stock when they take on dandelion as well. I mean, dandelion and plantain, those are the leaves that I will pick up from the garden coming back to the house, and I'll put a few leaves in my salad as well.
Yeah.
So it just stands to reason that once we integrate and have a far wider selection. Okay, it's profound, really, how we're having to relearn and realise the great disconnection we've had, and now we have to come forward. And so from there to soil, I'm really wanting to look at soil, because I went to Findhorn way back in 1977, and I stood and looked and walked around and sort of played with their compost system. And I realised that there are so many other compost systems too, but this is to get your soil and your microorganisms all working together and put them around your plant, you can have your plant zoom up if you have your balance of microorganisms, get that fungi and bacteria happening.
Yes, and of course our systems at our, I would say the conventional and dominant systems at the moment, aren't enhancing the microorganisms, the natural balance in the soil. And as I say, I despair that we lost so many soil scientists. I hope it's restored. Also lost our last seat for agro-ecological systems from Lincoln years ago.
That's terrible.
It is. And so we'll get back there, but it is good that there are also input providers, so people that are selling products to farmers and horticulturists that do recognise the need for more diverse microorganisms and are selling products that to help put them back in there. But really, a good system that would be happening on farm, and we wouldn't be using urea, superphosphate, things like that. They actually degrade the soil life and help also remove carbon from the soil and the like. So there's a lot of arguments around carbon and the soil, and I heard someone on the radio the other day talking up dairy industry because of the cow manure, I'll call it that, helps bring carbon to the soil, and they were suggesting that they'll be seeing increased carbon on dairy farms. Now, that might be just, but if they're using the superphosphate type fertilisers and urea, they'll be getting way, way less than they could do if they were having a less intensive but a more diverse farm.
I've just come back. I just last week came back from Austria, and so I did a lot of hiking, and the foothills, so to speak, green. You'd have thought that they would have put lime everywhere, and we were walking in a group of us, and I said, I smelled that, and I said, God, you know what, that's cow manure. And sure enough, they were getting their cow manure, and they were dragging it up on tractors, and they were spreading it out in such a way that they were getting this lush, real lush grass. They weren't overdoing it, mm-hmm. so that the cows could come. I don't know, I didn't ask them how
soon later after.
That's right. Yeah. But I realised they were still using old ways.
Yes.
And we here in New Zealand, because, I mean, I was on a farm there, we had all AI cows way back in the 1960s, artificially inseminated. We're one of the first herds in the world that was artificially inseminated. And then Dad was found himself in a scientific revolution, which he didn't actually like. He said, it's getting too scientific. But getting back to Austria, they know certain ways that have produced very well for them. And I looked at all the creeks. I got photographs of all the creeks, and the water is clean, and there's no green algae on any stones or any rocks. So I know that the ecology around there is vibrant and alive.
Yeah, well, Austria is one of the countries that's got a good leaning towards organics and sustainable production. And there's the vineyards over there as well. They'll have trees around them, and they're just a beautiful picture. In my area in Marlborough, and you see that in the Hawke's Bay to a large degree too, we have this monoculture thing, and there's concern about the trees that might house birds that might eat the grapes, and we just lost that diversity, and it's very industrial. So I look again to that, moving back to something that's a more balanced, diverse landscape and production rather than having these monocultures.
Yeah, very true. I'm speaking with Stephen Browning, who was a Member of Parliament for the Green Party. I'm up north, you've been to my place, Stephen, and there's about 31 different birds, a lot of seabirds in that area, and I know at least about 28 of them by sound, and my ears pick them up all the time. And I realise this diversity of birds is so important, particularly if you want your thrushes and blackbirds in the garden, and sure, sometimes they will scratch out seedlings, etc. But again, bird life, imperative.
Yes, and we talked earlier about the drop in insects. That's caused a major drop in bird life as well, of course, around the farmland in particular. So, we want the diversity. We realised that there was some damage from birds, there's damage from insects sometimes too, but if you get the balance reasonably right, there's something for them and there's lots for us.
I remember reading a bit when Captain Cook first came to New Zealand. He came, I think, to Queen Charlotte Sound. Yep. And in the book it said there that they tied a rope up to a tree for the stern of the boat, and they threw the anchor out in the front, and the boat just sat there for that night, and the watchman was watching, and he said all the rats were running along the rope from the stern up into a tree. And when they woke up the next morning, they were overwhelmed with the cacophony of sound of this gigantic dawn's chorus that resounded right around the whole sound. It was the most magnificent chorus of existence.
Yeah.
But the rats were there.
That's
the rats had escaped, and we, in many ways, have brought so much devastation to New Zealand, which means I want to get round to biosecurity.
Yes, so biosecurity was one of my subject areas, but I'm also just, it was only this last week, I think, at a public meeting with Eugenia Sage talking about predator-free New Zealand, and that was hosted by Picton Dawn Chorus. Just down the the sound from where Captain Cook was,
yes,
there's a fantastic, no toxins, purely trapping thing going on around Picton to bring the birds back into Picton, and they're just going to keep on moving out, and they're dedicated to doing it without toxins. So Picton Dawn Chorus people need a real pat on the back. They're having great success, and at the same time we have the issue of 1080.
Thank you.
I thought you might go there, Tim.
You brought it up, fortunately, but this is it, because on greenplanetfm.com, if you go in, there's Bob Tate and Dennis Trussell have done an interview, and it was only about, I don't know, 3 months ago. And in it, there's a piece, there's a four-minute video, and it tells of a scientist called Dr. Mike Meads was going to present some findings to the Royal New Zealand Society, because he found that 1080 was killing up to 50% of the insects. But 10 days before he was going to do his presentation, Doc fired him and closed down the whole story. And Dr. Mike Meads died. And this was all just then covered over, and nobody knows anything about it. But fortunately, there's some very good human beings who have followed up on this, and we need to realise that we've got to find another way, because New Zealand uses something like about 80% of the world's total of 1080. And so why are other countries not using it?
Other countries aren't using it for a range of reasons. A lot of them will have indigenous mammals, and so because it's such a good mammalian killer, they don't want to kill their native animals. So they have to, if they're using 1080, it has to be incredibly carefully so that they don't do it. Here, when it's used, there's clearly, how would I say, there's a bycatch apart from the intended primary targets, might be possums and or rats. There's a lot of people will be just as happy to see the goats, the deer and the pigs killed at the same time, and cats and ferrets and stoats and everything, because they're all imported and they're all causing carnage to our biodiversity in some way. I had great difficulty in the sounds when trying to work out, do I support or object to 1080 being used in my backyard, effectively out there in the outer Pelorus Sound. In the bush, we had goats, possums, pigs, deer browsing, and so the potential replacement for the canopy wasn't coming up. It was being browsed down. There's just a few unpalatable ferns and a few other trees occasionally getting through. And then, of course, the pigs were coming along and rooting it up, because it was, they could very easily, and this was like a rotary hoe was there. This was quite steep country, and of course a lot of that was getting washed down as well and into the sounds and smothering fisheries habitats and spawning areas. So there's a big ecological problem there. How do you deal with it? Do you do 1080 that will kill a lot of those mammals? But, and there's an argument for it potentially, but there's a couple of real problems with it. One is, from an animal welfare thing, you wouldn't allow a farmer to do that. He'd be in court, he'd be not allowed to be looking after animals or anything like that. It's a very, very cruel death. The other thing is, the real effect on that wider ecology that you allude to, Tim, around the insects, I don't believe is understood. There has been some basic science done in New Zealand to do with what would affect cultural animals or plants, watercress for the boil up, cura, the freshwater crayfish, and it was found that
eels
to a degree. Now, the science has said, well, hey, there's no big death rate on those animals. So
at the moment?
Yes, and that is it. They call it the LD50, how many die at a certain dosage, and 50% of the population of keep dosing them up, or whatever. Cura will focus on that. The freshwater crayfish doesn't really die easily with 1080. But one thing they didn't do is check on multi-generational reproductive success.
Thank you.
The endocrine disruption or whatever. And I might have said it before to you, Tim, the blue-tongued lizard in Australia, where it is used sometimes to kill imported foxes very carefully, whatever, but they tested the blue-tongued lizard and it affects its sperm tubes.
Yes.
I haven't seen the science to know whether that's just scarred it or whether it's made it infertile or whatever. But with the cura, there was no look at secondary poisoning issues, or secondary would be going into another animal, whatever, that might feed on the cura, but more what is its reproductive success? Was there organ damage? Was there endocrine damage, so in the hormonal system? And there's likely to be some, as we know with most pesticides.
Yes.
That has not been studied, and the scientist that did that cura study said there just wasn't the resources. He said, of course I would like to do that study. That's Dr. Alistair Surin from NIWA. But he was also saying that water that they tested on my behalf, because I was opposing the drops and was able to decide where the water test should happen.
Yes.
And there's more than 50% found to have 1080 at very low levels in there, and at different times I could predict there would be higher levels. Yet he was suggesting that it was safe. There's no safety because the science hasn't been done to genuinely prove the safety, because we're just not putting the resources in for the deeper ecological science around it. I'm really hoping, as we move on, and they are improving how they do the drops, unfortunately they're doing broader areas while they're doing it as well, that there won't be the insect damage because they're doing smaller swathes of the drops when they do it. But I'm hoping, like Hang, that we do not have real serious long-term ecological problems out of it. But we cannot say that with surety at the moment because the science just isn't done. And so while the drops continue, if they wish to continue them, and my colleague, Yuzani Sage, who's absolutely deeply concerned about the loss of biodiversity and birds in particular, we need her and others putting way more resources into the research. We need way more resources going into community, non-toxic and or ground control systems of control. We need hunters out there as well.
Yeah.
We need to make, and my old friend, well, Donald, who's long passed now,
yes,
he had a possum skin seat cover in Parliament. And that was because he saw the potential of having community businesses, industries set up where people were properly honoured and paid well for their work on the ground to deal with pests to help bring our bird song back, but at the same time looking to make value out of the products where possible.
Very good, yes, because possum fur, you can integrate it with wool or mohair, and if there's no TB in the possum, that can be used as pet food. So many possibilities. Oh, we've got to keep on trucking and moving on, because one thing is huge amounts of money needs to go into biosecurity on the borders. And I know that there is a gigantic problem at the moment. There's all sorts of things coming in ships, in the ballast and ships, and, oh, gosh, I mean, it's a big one, isn't it?
I mean, Damien O'Connor's working hard to try and deal with mycoplasma. And that's one thing I said right at the start. I was still in Parliament at the time. You've got to get in and you've got to cull it straight away and get in there. And, of course, they prevaricated and mucked around.
And who was this? National Party?
National Party was in at the time. Yep. And Nathan Guy had...
I'll shut up. You carry
on. Well, Nathan rebuilt the budget for biosecurity after his predecessor in National, Dave Carter, had culled it significantly. But it still is not doing the job. It only brought it up to the standards that had happened when they came into government in the first place. And we were having, and that had already brought Varroa and other things in. We've got major problems with what's coming in. I'm optimistic that Damien will improve things. But in fact, we all must take a personal responsibility in how we manage ourselves coming in through the borders as well when we go in and out, that we're not bringing in new pests and that. Then it's a matter of their skills to acknowledge and jump on things quickly and promptly. And I just see it time after time. And
we dropped the ball.
You know it.
We dropped the ball. Yeah. Now, right. A lot of people don't realise that. How many cows could be culled in New Zealand? Just quickly.
I can't remember.
700,000?
Yes. It's tens into hundreds of thousands.
Horrendous. Yeah.
This is.
So biosecurity. Now I'm going to jump it.
Okay.
Big time. National security. And you come from Marlborough,
yep.
And you've lived there, and just up the road is Waihopai, the mm-hmm. Five Eyes, the listening station echelon that records and listens to everything electronic, to all the different chatter, all emails, all text, all
electronic communications.
Yep.
So, yeah, that is in my backyard, and I don't often miss the annual pilgrimage by others to come to it to protest it. I did last year. I was away. But, yes, that should be closed down, just per se. It's just stopped. It persists regardless of who's in Parliament
yes.
at the time. It seems
yes.
to have a power over and beyond the government of the day, and I find that appalling, that the people can bring in a government and say the Greens are a significant part of it,
yes.
And we cannot seem to close that down. In fact, what National did was bring in laws that made that, rather than just being external spying base or whatever, and the GCSB, the Government Security and Communications Bureau, spying externally just to keep us safe in theory, could actually turn around and spy on us much more easily. And the telecommunications and deception bill that I was all over when I was in there, that came in as well. And that came in and they celebrated it effectively when the spy agency bosses and the police force bosses around the world were in New Zealand. They celebrated those changes to the law that made it more easy to spy on New Zealanders. It was appalling, disgusting, and somehow we've got to overcome this.
I fluke going into a room. I don't have a TV. I fluke going into a room, and the TV was on, and you were speaking to that, and you had said that the Attorney Generals for America, Canada, UK, Australia, and New Zealand were all in New Zealand at that time.
That's right.
Celebrating this. So this is terrible. And from what I gather, the different countries can say, no, we're not spying on our own country, but every country spies on everybody else's country, and so that they can slip out the back door there. So it's a big problem. And I realised, too, that James Clapper, who was the NSA chief, happened to be down in New Zealand some years ago, and he was caught getting onto an aeroplane flying back to the States after having been with John Key in New Zealand security apparatus, because some keen photographer had been at Wellington Airport, photographed the plane, blew it up, and there was James Clapper getting on board. Now, the interesting thing about James Clapper is that he, in many ways, has lied on a number of occasions to Congress. And I just see here that in usatoday.com and also in usnews.com, they are saying, lock him up. Lawmakers renew calls for James Clapper perjury charges. And here we are in New Zealand listening to this man, and he's been in the security apparatus for some unknown reason. He has huge immunity, and just 10 days ago, I must throw this in, he threw Obama under the bus by stating that Obama had said, let's spy on Trump in 2016. And so what's happening is, when it comes to international security and our agreements with Uncle Sam, there is so many crooked deals going on, and I just am horrified that this is happening. Can you give us 30 seconds on this?
Oh, well, New Zealand, we've seen plenty of lies, including from prime ministers of the day around security and everything, and when that bill was going through, and John Key in particular I'm thinking of, and I'm just, more and more will come out on that man and others, but at the same time we're still, and we'll expose it, and they'll say, oh yeah, but he's not there now, but the beast is still there, that dreadful spying apparatus. And people may think, it doesn't matter because I'm not doing anything wrong, but what you, your lifestyle is, and now, and the things that you find important may be considered by a later government or personnel to be not seen as ideal. You'll be, there'll be some vested interest concerned with your interests, and you may well be the target more than you realise. So we're certainly being very surveilled. The last thing we need is our communications being shared with the US, for example, for every last thing being put into storage about you that can be pulled up later.
Thank you for that. Yeah, surveilled. Now, I mean, it means I want to take it up to the next level. And we get round to the fact that I flew as crew for Air New Zealand from 1976 to 1993. And I was on up there on the flight deck looking at life, and even though I could see what was happening, I saw oil slicks over the Pacific Ocean, I saw soot over the ice in the Greenland, I saw clay areas in Malaysia where there were once trees, and the tropical rains had even washed the stumps away out to sea or over the so-called spawning grounds around Malaysia. And we used to, in those days, in 1976, used to fly through the atmospheric debris of Los Angeles Airport. It was just shocking in those days, and they've done a very good job at cleaning it up. However, what it is that I never, ever saw these things called contrails, chemtrails, or whatever you want to call it.
Vapor trails.
Vapor trails. Okay, thank you. And I didn't see anything other than the fact that a vapor trail would only last maybe 20 to 50 seconds, and that's it. Now, I've been up in the States recently, and I photographed a whole lot of trails in the sky sitting there. And I also have just come back from Austria and Germany, and sure enough, I photographed a lot. I'm willing to share these photographs with anybody. A lot of people, from what I hear, have approached you about these, and they say that there's supposedly to deflect sunlight back into space, and that a lot of these nanoparticles are made of barium, aluminium and strontium. You've heard stories too.
I certainly have, and and you're absolutely right, Tim. I've had a lot of people push a lot of material at me. Some I've read and some I haven't, because I had so much on my plate.
Yes.
And I can never do enough on those issues, and will push on still on those, particularly those other issues. I also believe that some of what they're saying is probably not correct, but I cannot rule out some of it being correct.
When in New Zealand, in particularly?
Well, maybe. When I was a child, and I'm 64 now, I remember the efforts to cloud seed clouds because of the major drought in Marlborough at the time to try and get it to rain. It wasn't successful. I've got no doubt that there is experimentation. In fact, I know Malta took the UK to court over chemtrails over Malta, because I thought it was affecting their agriculture because it was blocking the sun so much with crisscrossing there. And I think there was some level of success around that. So, of course, we know that agencies or even companies will be experimenting with these things, at least experimenting, to see whether they can have effect to reduce the effects of climate change. I think they're idiots if they are doing that. The same as the people that are trying to seed plankton growth in the sea to absorb carbon, they don't know what they're doing in terms of the ecological weird
consequences.
And yes, the danger is immense. So when I see, and I've taken loads of photographs too, Tim, I do listen and I take my own observations. Is that a pure vapor trail or a condensation trail, which is water effectively turning into cloud out of the water from the exhaust of the plane? Most likely that's what it is. It's interesting how they last and they spread, and I've seen my total Marlborough skyscape, I suppose, with a light, we call it fine high cloud.
Yes.
But I've also seen, watched the vapour trails actually spread bit by bit to form that. Now, is that just like normal cloud formation? And maybe it is, because it tends to happen under certain atmospheric conditions rather than others. So I've got no proof at all that there's anything more than water vapour forming that. There might be. I know there's idiots out there that will be playing with those sorts of things, as certainly in other parts of the world. For it to be every vapour trail that we go across, that goes across the sky, I seriously doubt it. But my ears and eyes are still open to some degree on that, and I just think we need to be watching and trying to collate information, and also putting the pressure on to say, if you're even thinking about it, agencies or states, don't.
Yes. Yes, it's very interesting, because I'm at the beach and I've photographed some very long, long trails. And it was just that I checked chemtrailsnorthnz.wordpress.com, and there was some stuff there that I thought, ah, oh, gee.
I have been told that jet engines are quite different now and they are more likely to do a particular type of trail. I don't know. I'm not that expert.
Yes, yes. So I've seen pipes hanging off aircrafts or photographs too, so we've got to have a look at this one. But in the meantime, I'm waiting for humanity to really realise that we're a global family and we've got to actually come together to solve all these problems, because we're at multiple tipping points of economic, societal and ecological. And I just want to say thank you so much, Stefan, for wanting to keep going and keep pushing the envelope to bring more insight to the world, bring us together so that the children of today and tomorrow can really have a life to look forward to.
Thanks, Tim, and I'm remaining optimistic against the negative stuff we see and we deal with so much. But there's some fantastic, as I say, vitality coming on with another generation of, we'll call it succession, into these issues. And just look at this fantastic change around plastic that actually came in my lifetime, but has been shown to be bad and has serious consequences. It's being shut down reasonably quickly, but the speed of current change, it gives you hope that these other issues can change very quickly as well. And if we can get that sort of change and get away from more stuff, more consumer stuff, we'll take away some of the root causes. So thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Stefan. That was Stefan Browning, who used to be a Member of Parliament for the Green Party here in New Zealand. Decide to network. Use every letter you write, every conversation you have, every meeting you attend, every email you send. And remember, even Facebook, to tweet and to express your fundamental beliefs and dreams. Affirm to others the vision of the world you want. Network through thought. Network through action. Network through love. Network through the spirit. You are the center of a network. You are the center of the world. You are a free, immensely powerful source of life and goodness. Affirm it. Spread it. Radiate it. Think day and night about it, and you will see a miracle happen. The greatness of your own life in a world of big powers, media and monopolies, but of 7.6 billion individuals, networking is the new freedom, the new democracy, a new transparency, and a new form of wholeness and happiness. This originated by Dr. Robert Muller, Chancellor of the World Peace University in Costa Rica, Central America. I invite you to be able to come to greenplanetfm.com, where we have over 400 interviews in our database, which you can readily download and listen to be able to inspire yourself to become the change you want to see in the world. And become involved in caring for your children and grandchildren's future. We are also on Facebook, on Green Planet FM, and ourplanet.org. Please come and love us. This is Tim Lynch.
And or Lisa Eyre. And Liz Gunn.
In the spirit of Aroha, wishing you a wonderful week. We look forward to being with you next week. I say Kia Kaha and Haere Uraha.